Today's guests, Senator Burke Hickenlooper and Congressman Melvin Laird. Our panel consists of Holmes Alexander of the McNaught Syndicate, Marquis Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Ray Scherer of NBC News, and Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications. Ned Brooks is our moderator.
Our guests today are the chairman and the co-chairman of the Republican Joint Congressional Committee, which has just issued a new declaration of principles and policy. They are Representative Melvin Laird of Wisconsin and Senator Burke Hickenlooper of Iowa. Now here is the first question from Marquis Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Mr. Laird, your declaration of policy has been criticized for being so generalized that almost anybody could run on it, Republican or Democrat. It's for all the political virtues and against all the political evils. I wonder if you could tell us why a Democrat or a moderate or anybody is excluded from running on the basis of this broad declaration.
Well, Mr. Childs, I don't agree with the premise of your question. I believe that this is rather specific in many broad areas. First, we make a very definite stand on aid to communist countries, which is in opposition to the administration. We make a definite stand on selective aids for education rather than massive general aids, as was in the Senate bill. We're very specific in our statements in foreign policy as far as victory over communism through the establishment of a world in which freedom, security, and individuals can live in national independence as opposed to accommodation with the communists. I believe that there are 35 very specific areas where we bring into focus the difference between the two major political parties as we go into this 1962 election.
Now, your party itself covers a very broad range, Mr. Laird. You've got three John Birch Society members nominated out in California to run for Congress. On the other hand, you've got Senator Javits in New York, Senator Cooper in Kentucky, who apparently are critical of your document or have some reservations about it. Is this document broad enough to cover that whole range, from the John Birch Society, for example, to the liberals or moderates in your party?
Well, I believe that this document speaks for itself. Now, you talk about some reservations that individual members may have. Senator Cooper, I understand, does make some point of taking a reservation on the word bankruptcy. However, in his speech, which he made to the Republican State Convention in Connecticut on June 4th, he spoke of failure of the Kennedy administration in the area of Cuba and Laos and other areas. Now, bankruptcy and failure seem to me to mean the same thing. I believe that this document is one which is a consensus of opinion of the various members of the House and of the United States Senate. We tried to work out a consensus of opinion and went to all of them for their ideas and their views before this document was submitted to the Republican Senate and House conferences.
But you do feel that this covers the whole range from the extreme right to the moderate or liberal left.
Well, I want to make it very clear. We do not use the term conservative, liberal, or moderate in this document. I believe this document speaks for itself. And we started out in the first meeting we had of this committee, we stayed away from those particular terms because we tried to set forth the differences between the two parties and the differences which have existed and have come into play since the writing of our last political document in 1960. This is to update the 1960 Republican Party platform, and that is what we have done in this document, a declaration of Republican principle and policy.
Now, you mentioned the fact of aid to communist countries, and you say that aid should not be extended to any communist state that is not making progress toward development of free institutions. Now, under that definition, all aid to Poland, for example, would be stopped. Is that right, Mr.
Well, I believe it would be at this particular time. That is subject to interpretation. If Poland can make a case that it is moving towards free institutions, it would qualify under this language. I personally do not believe, in my own mind, that Poland is moving towards those free institutions, and I certainly think Yugoslavia is not. That could have been said perhaps a few years ago, but I do not believe that you could say that now.
We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Wilson.
Senator Hickenlooper, I wonder if in trying to bridge the differences in the Republican Party, you haven't actually straddled a great many issues, such as, for example, your opposition to what you refer to as an increasing spiral of government expenditures. and yet at the same time you advocate a massive land retirement program. How can you reduce government expenditures, for example, and spend several billion dollars retiring land from agricultural production?
Well, of course, if one spent, or if we spent several billion dollars retiring land, it would be an increased expenditure. Most of us believe that sufficient land can be retired so that the cost of the agricultural program will be actually less. Now, there was some objection in our conference on the Senate side to the word massive as to what it meant. Well, massive means a large amount. We now have 20-some million, perhaps 28 million acres of land retired. That's a massive amount of land. 30 million, 50 million is a massive amount. 70 million is a massive amount. We did not specify the exact amount of land, and at least in my feeling, a retirement program can be put into effect which will actually reduce the cost of the agriculture program rather than increase it.
Well, you have another case here. I don't think you meet squarely. Perhaps you do, and you can correct me. The question of whether medical care for the aged and medical expenses in other fields shall be met entirely by private expenditure, or whether some of this expenditure shan't be financed by Social Security taxes. Now, do you meet that issue squarely?
Well, I think that is stated in general philosophy rather than specific programs. There are five or six medical bills, which are, portions of which at least, are attractive to various members. I think we attempt to state the philosophy that self-help programs should be advocated as broadly as possible, that the question of proven need is a field in which the government has a responsibility. Now, of course, many of us are definitely opposed to the Social Security approach for several reasons, because it doesn't reach all the people that are in need, and because, as it is now proposed, it doesn't reach the doctor bills and things of that kind.
Yes, but many leading Republicans, including Governor Rockefeller, are in favor of the Social Security approach, modified, that is, from the Kennedy proposals, but still it is a Social Security approach.
Well, it probably can be a Social Security approach in certain particulars or certain details, but not in the main. I mean, not as a total approach.
I wonder, Senator, there are maybe contradictions and straddles in this. What was the reason for devoting all this time and energy to the preparation of a statement which could not pinpoint exactly where the Republican Party stood on specific issues?
Well, I think in the first place, Mr. Wilson, this was not an attempt to rewrite the 1960 Republican platform. We made it clear that we do not contravene that platform at all. This was an attempt to state general broad principles pointing the way to the overall attitude of the Republicans in the House and the Senate. Manifestly, as you get into specific details on specific pieces of legislation, you get divergent views. This was an attempt to bring a composite approach to broad principles upon which the Republicans in both houses will stand. Therefore, specific details had to be left out in many cases on certain issues because the approach to those details and the way it could be said was something that would be difficult indeed to arrive at unanimity on. We did arrive at unanimity on this program. I can say that we did arrive at unanimity. There were two dissenting opinions in the Senate side, but each of those only went to a specific item in this 2,400-page document, which I think all the rest of the document they approved of, but in each case just one specific small item was disapproved, and they felt that they
2,400 words, wasn't it?
2,400 words. I'm sorry. It was almost 2,400 pages when you started.
Mr. Alexander.
Congressman Laird, your colleague, Congressman Carl Anderson, has admitted to some financial association with Billy Saul Estes, and he says that he's been ostracized by his Republican House colleagues, and that he has, in effect, resigned from the party and is going to run as an independent. This has the look of a man being pressured out of the party. Our first question is that so?
No, I think that that is not so, that decision was made by Mr. Anderson himself, and I believe that those questions are up to the voters of his congressional district.
Wouldn't it be a good thing if a man who had been publicly criticized felt that he should withdraw from the party? Wouldn't that be a very fine way to clean house?
Well, I certainly think that I believe that a man is innocent until he's proven guilty, and I haven't looked into these particular charges at all. And the decision that Mr. Anderson made was his own decision.
Well, let me press you a little bit on that. Do you think the party has any responsibility for its members? If a fellow does have an association that's does the party no credit and himself no credit, don't you think he should get out, and don't you think the party should perhaps ask him out?
Well, if he is guilty of wrongdoing, I think that is certainly true. But this matter is being looked into by congressional committees at the present time, and I do not have information of guilt at this time.
Generally speaking, though, you think the country would have a lot more confidence in the two parties if they did ask...
Oh, I certainly do. And when guilt is proved, I would certainly believe that... That should be the case, and that our parties should try to clean house on themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Scheer.
Senator Hickenlooper, Senator Cooper of Kentucky made known that he has reservations of what the document says about foreign policy. Senator Javits has some, too. Is it considered constructive to charge the administration with whimpering on Laos when the political situation there may finally be on the delicate point of resolution? And what does whimpering mean?
Well, of course, you get to the use of terms, the use of words. I think the reference to Laos is more effective as a demonstration of policy which has vacillated and which has not been firm. As an example of history, for instance, which should not be repeated, that it should be used to correct future actions. Now, I think... Senator Cooper had some objection. I think every member of the committee, or perhaps most of the members of the House and the Senate, perhaps would have written certain details of this report in a little different verbiage. You can't get a couple of hundred people together and write a document that is written in the verbiage that every last one of them would use if he were writing the document. This was an attempt at a composite statement to point up the issues, to point the principle. And in the case of the foreign policy, it had to be a broad statement. I would not myself necessarily write the foreign policy statement exactly as it was written. I approve of its general connotations.
Am I correct in assuming then that it was toned down to accommodate Senators Cooper and Javits?
It was not changed at all.
Not toned down.
From the final draft, which was arrived at by the Committee of 12, that final draft was not altered.
Do you think the present policy in Laos is wrong of striving for a neutral coalition?
I think at the present time it may be the only avenue of operation which we have in Laos. My criticism of Laos is is what went on a year or so ago in Laos. I am not in favor, for instance, or was not in favor, of pointing toward a neutralist combination government in Laos where the commies were invited in. I think such a government has always failed in the world, and I think it will fail. But we have reached the point now, practically the point of no return in Laos, when about the only avenue open is such a salvation there, if it can be possible. So it's one of those inevitable things that one has to face.
But,
One question about the statement. You say the great issue is which party acts more effectively to preserve and enlarge human freedom. That's rather general. How do you dramatize that in an election time? How do you use that this fall?
Well, I think you use it by emphasizing the necessity for enlarging the encouragement of free enterprise, because I think that's the only way that you can extend and expand human freedom is to extend the opportunity and the freedom of the individual. And I think we point out rather clearly that this administration is perhaps curtailing the opportunity of the individual in its programs and its repeated demands for power and money and extension of central authority and government. And we believe in the opposite. Less government control over the people, more expansion of opportunity and encouragement and responsibility on the part of the individual.
Mr. Wilson.
Congressman Laird, I'd like to get a little nearer to the reality on the reason for this statement. I'll repeat to you some of the gossip that you can hear in the halls at Congress and ask you to comment on them. The piece of gossip you hear is that a great many Republicans in Congress and elsewhere were tired of having the entire spokesmanship of the party seem to rest with the majority of the minority leaders of the House and Senate. Mr. Halleck and Senator Dirksen. Was this a motivating factor in the preparation of this declaration?
Well, I think the motivating factor in preparation of this document was the fact that we Republicans have had somewhat of a communications problem. When we are a minority party and the White House is in control of the majority party and the Congress is in control of the majority party, the Democratic Party now, we do have a communications problem. On each of the major issues that have faced this session of Congress and the last session of the 87th Congress, the Republicans have had a positive program in each of these areas. Take aid to depressed areas. We had a positive substitute which gave to the real emphasis on training individuals to in the retraining and vocational training program rather than aid to industry or subsidies to local communities. In each of the areas that we have had legislation on the floor of the House of Representatives, the Republicans have had a positive position. And we wanted to communicate this position in a more direct way with the voters as we went into the 1962 election.
Did both Governor Rockefeller and Senator Goldwater approve this statement?
Well, Governor Rockefeller was asked for suggestions by me. I had him down here as a guest for a breakfast in which I invited some 100 members of the House of Representatives to be present. He made suggestions as to our party philosophy as we went into the 1962 election. Senator Goldwater was also asked for comments. We asked all of the Republican governors, the 16 Republican governors throughout the United States, President Hoover, General Eisenhower, and others for their suggestions, and we tried the best we could to incorporate a statement and to come up with a statement, which was a hard-hitting statement, a campaign document, as we went into the 1962 election.
Mr. Childs.
Senator Hickenlooper, I'd like to see if we could get some examples within these definitions. You say in your declaration that government must not substitute its decision for free bargaining in the marketplace. You'll recall that late in 1959, Vice President Nixon did a very effective job of settling the SEAL strike, calling the principals out to his house and doing a very important job out of which he got a lot of political mileage. Do you think that that was an example of wrongful intervention by your definition?
No, not at all, because that was an attempt at mediation between the parties, bringing the parties together so that they could arrive at a mutually acceptable position under bargaining which was not controlled or dictated by either side. I think what we refer to there is that the power of government should not move in to dictate and control, to dictate what labor will do, to dictate what management will do. And I don't consider the Nixon activity as a dictation. I consider it as a mediation.
Well, one more example. After the steel union and the industry had reached an agreement on wages, steel prices were raised. Do you think that President Kennedy overstepped the bounds of this definition when he persuaded the steel industry to rescind the price increase?
Well, I think what President Kennedy did, and I can't pass on whether an increase in steel was necessary or not. That is an economic thing. But I think what President Kennedy did in that case was to use all of the vast, ramified power of government and government agencies to coerce and compel the steel companies to accept a price level which the steel companies said was not realistic in view of the increased costs. Now, I think that is wrong whether he applies it to labor, whether he applies it to management or ownership. Now, I think that is the thing that we are pointing to. It is the coercion or compulsion of government in a free enterprise system to compel either one or both sides of a dispute to accept what the whimsical decision of a government bureaucrat desires.
Mr. Shearer.
Congressman Laird, on page 4, you say that Republicans urge vigorous investigation of fraud at the polls and recommend corrective action. Is this pointed at a specific instance?
Well, it's pointed at the 1960 elections, Mr. Shearer. We had certain evidence in Chicago, in Texas, in Philadelphia, and other areas where there was fraud at the polls. And the Republican minority of the House Judiciary Committee in the so-called Cramer Amendment made certain recommendations. That amendment has not been enacted into law. We believe that it should be vigorously pursued so that the right to vote of each individual citizen is protected.
Now, on the same page, you call for effective tax relief for medical and hospital insurance, and you also call for tax relief for financing education. How would this work?
First, as far as medical and hospital insurance is concerned, I think you'll recall that in the Republican 80th Congress, an amendment was adopted to the Internal Revenue Code, which provided that for a double exemption over the age of 65. At the present time, in the Internal Revenue Code, there is a 3% provision that you can't deduct any amount unless it exceeds 3% of the gross income. We believe that this provision should be done away with because many people that are buying medical and health insurance at the present time are unable to deduct it from their income taxes. Now, in education, we feel we are opposed to the so-called massive approach of general federal aid, which passed the Senate last year. We are for the selective approach. We believe that we can do much more good by giving tax incentives, tax relief. We had some members of our committee that were for a tax credit proposal in this educational area, others for a tax deduction. Our statement gives general support to this idea, but we spell it out as far as tax relief for the individual paying for the cost of education for himself or for others.
Mr. Alexander.
Senator Hickenlooper, in the newspaper business, we like to see proper names used. And I'd like to read this little passage from your declaration. It says, the administration's lack of sympathy toward a free, competitive economy has been made plain by its principal advisors. They have expressed the pessimistic theory, and they have argued so forth and so on. Now, who are they? Who do you mean?
You mean the administration's advisors?
Yes, sir. You call them their principal advisors, and you call them they, but you never mention them by name.
I would call such people as Galbraith and Schlesinger and... Mr. Galbraith, or Ambassador Galbraith, Mr. Schlesinger, Mr. Rostov, and people of that kind who are theoretically economists and so on as the chief advisors on general philosophy and policy of this administration. There are many others.
I heard you question Ed Murrow when he was before your committee to become U.S. information chief, and you were pretty critical of him. Have you changed your mind at all about him?
Not at all.
Gentlemen, at this point, we'll have to suspend our questions, and thank you very much, Congressman Laird and Senator Hickenlooper, for being with us.